That's right. That complicated, that such complicated formulas can produce such simple results make you think there may be a second way of formulating things. That's something which is, at the moment, there's lots and lots of hints that such a thing exists, and people are learning more and more about it. But it's not, that's not at a stage where you can write a book. You know, no one even understands it yet. It's just, I think, there's more evidence that such a second formulation actually exists. But independent of whether the formalism exists, it's true that the answers are written in terms of these variables. So it's just a good idea to see what they look like, just so you get a feeling for it. OK, what I want to do now is tell you about some of the absolute simplest amplitudes, starting with the naively simplest ones, and then we'll go to an even simpler one. The naively simplest amplitudes involve two particles scattering in and two coming out. That's 2-to-2 scattering. Okay. And let's first imagine these particles are all scalars. So a first interesting thing to do is just to figure out, what are all the possible Lorentz invariants that the amplitude can depend on? Okay. It's just a function of scalars. It should be Lorentz invariant. Okay. Well, I mean, all the Lorentz invariants I could possibly have are inner products of all these guys, right? So I can have p1 dot p1. That's 0. I can have p1 dot p2, p1 dot p3, p1 dot p4, p2 dot p3, p2 dot p4. P3 dot P4. Okay? So I can have a total of, it looks like I have many different invariants. Actually, there's many fewer invariants than that. There's actually only 2 independent invariants here. Okay? Let's kind of see why. Like, for example, I can think of P1 dot P2. I can think of it as P1 plus P2 squared. Right? That's 2 P1 dot P2 because P1 squared and P2 squared is 0, right? The particles are all massless. But by momentum conservation, this is also equal to negative P3, negative P4 squared, right? Which is 2 P3 dot P4. So P1 dot P2 and P3 dot P4 are the same. Similarly, p4 dot p1 and p3 dot p2 are the same. And p2 dot p4 and p3 dot p1 are the same. Okay? So people conventionally call S to be p1 plus p2 squared, or 2p1 dot p2. T is equal to, I guess in this picture, it would be p1 plus p4 squared. Is 2p1 dot p4, and u is p1 plus p3 squared. Yes?
Are incoming and the which are
everything is incoming. Huh? These are momenta, so the direction of the arrows isn't time. This is just, I'm just labeling all the momenta as incoming. So depending on which one of these momenta have negative energy components, you would interpret as a process which particles are coming in and particles are going out in a different way. Okay. Actually, there's even a relationship between S, T, and U. S plus T plus U is 0. Because after all, that's just, if you just take P1 plus P2 plus P3 squared, let's say, this is a trivial exercise. Just you can verify it for yourself. So in fact, there's only 2 independent kinematical invariants that you can take to be S and T, or S and U, or T and U. Okay? People often conveniently keep them as S, T, and U, remembering in the back of their minds that s plus t plus u is equal to 0, because that keeps the permutation symmetry between all the particles manifest. Okay. So it doesn't make any preferential choices. So anyway, so an amplitude just for scalars is a function of s and t. I can write it as a function of s, t, and u if I want, with the proviso of remembering that s plus t plus u is 0. Okay. Now, without doing any work at all, let's see how much we can constrain the form, given what we now know. Let's see how much we can constrain the form of, let's say, a four-particle graviton amplitude. Terrifying, horrendous thing, but what is it? Well, for it to be a graviton amplitude, it has to have the correct weights. It should be a function of lambda 1, lambda tilde 1, lambda 2, lambda tilde 2, and so on. Okay? And it has to have the correct weights. So let's say I'm talking about a graviton amplitude where this is a plus helicity graviton. That's a plus helicity graviton, that's a minus helicity graviton, that's a minus helicity graviton. Okay. It turns out that just like for gluons, the amplitude for all plus helicity gravitons also vanishes. And all plus but one minus helicity graviton also vanishes. Okay. So this is the first one which does not vanish. And let me just write something down, and then we can talk about it. But just so you see how easy life is. You see, the negative helicity guys have to, under the rescaling of lambda and lambda tilde, lambda 1 and lambda tilde 1, if I rescale lambda 1 by e to the I theta and lambda tilde 1 by e to the minus I theta, then it had better have a net weight plus 4. Plus 4 because the graviton is spin 2, which is 4 times a half. Okay? So it has to have weight plus 4. 3 has weight plus 4. 4 has weight plus 4, and I've just not put in any angle brackets here at all for 3 and 4. And similarly, 1 and 2 I put in with, square brackets, 1 and 2 I put in with angle brackets. Okay? So anything else that I have, this already has all the correct weights. This already has all the correct weights to be compatible with the graviton amplitude for these guys and these guys. So anything else should just purely be Lorentz invariant. So everything else should only be a function of literally the dot products of momenta. In other words, things like s, t, and u. Let me be a little more specific about this. Let's look at p1 plus p2 squared. So this is 2p1 dot p2. Okay. Now, I told you that each one of the p's is a lambda times a lambda tilde. Okay. So what could p1 dot p2 possibly be in terms of the Lorentz invariants? Just think about that for a second. What could p1 dot p2 be? It should be something that has a lambda 1 and a lambda 2, and a lambda tilde 1 and a lambda tilde 2. Right? So what could it be? This is 2. I forget. Don't trust me on the twos. It's just that. It has to have two lambdas and two lambda tildes. These are the only Lorentz invariant ways of building something out of two lambdas, is to make an angle bracket, two lambda tildes to make a square bracket. So that's what p1 dot p2 is. But notice that this object has no weights under the rescalings that we talked about. Of course not, right? They're built out of p's. The p's have no weights in the rephasing that we're talking about. That was the whole point. You could rephase the lambda and the lambda tilde and leave the p invariant. Okay? So the normal Lorentz, the normal inner products that we're used to talking about are things which are also made out of angle and square brackets. They just happen to have vanishing weight. Okay? So a general amplitude when the particles have spin just has some net imbalance so that the whole object has the correct weight under the appropriate transformations. Okay? In fact, in this case is sufficiently simple that we can actually guess the correct answer. Okay? because something else that you know about this amplitude is that it should be dimensionless, some dimensionless scattering amplitude, right? Now, this is a graviton amplitude, so it's proportional to g Newton. This four-particle amplitude is proportional to g Newton. So really, there's a g Newton in front here. Now let's just look at units. G Newton is units of 1 over mass squared. The product of this guy is units of momentum. So this is 1 over mass squared. This is mass to the fourth. That's mass to the fourth. So this whole thing has units of mass to the sixth. So whatever this is, it has to have units of 1 over mass to the sixth. By the way, this fact that the amplitude has to be dimensionless is special for the 2 to 2 amplitude. We can, this is really an, well, the whole amplitude is, it would take me a little too long to explain what the rule is for what the general mass dimension of the amplitude should be for any number of particles. And just believe me for a second that it's dimensionless. Okay? There's actually another argument, a much better argument that we'll use in a moment. But just so you see how it goes, there's a unique function which is symmetrical in S, T, and U, which has mass dimension 1 over mass to the sixth. What is it? What are the mass dimensions of S? S is mass squared, right? So what could it be?
1 over the modulus of all.
Right, it's just 1 over S times C times U. So this is the answer for the four-particle graviton amplitude. Yes. This actually is the exact answer, but this argument doesn't tell you. This argument alone doesn't tell you. Okay. An argument that I'm about to say will nail everything. So, but yes, go ahead.
I don't see exactly why we have a gn to the power 1. How can we know the power of gn?
Well, one way of seeing why it should be this is just a this is really just intuitive. But one way of seeing this is that if we weren't doing this, but we were doing something else that also involved exchanging gravitons. See, here you're exchanging gravitons, right? If we had like one mass coming along and another mass coming along exchanging a graviton, exactly the same sort of diagram is what's giving you the long-range potential. And that's proportional to g Newton. So the same counting of coupling parameters goes into this computation as goes into that one. So it's proportional to g Newton in exactly the same way. Yes?
When you have a scattering, like if you do a Feynman diagram way, right, you can have terms with one graviton, with one virtual graviton, which are gn,
gotcha.
Which are gn squared. But because you can have the gn terms, it swaps all the others.
Well, this is the leading one. There are higher order terms which are smaller and smaller. This is not the full amplitude. Actually, this is the full amplitude. Yeah, okay. The full amplitude is of this form.
Yeah.
But the leading piece has this go like one over SPU, and then there are higher terms with more and more powers in GNU. Anyway, so this is not the full graviton amplitude. This is the so-called tree amplitude, the lowest approximation to the amplitude. But I'm just writing it down so you see. This is another formula, much like the formula that I wrote down for the 6 gluon amplitude. This is the 4 graviton amplitude. And like I said, if you're going to do this with a Feynman diagram calculation, even this contribution, this kind of contribution, would involve 80 terms there and 80 terms there. Okay. And then there are other diagrams. But it collapses to this very, very simple expression. OK. However, there's an even simpler, amplitude that one can talk about. And in a sense, this is the most primitive amplitude of all. And that's a 3-particle amplitude. Now, we normally don't talk about a 3-particle amplitude for massless particles. If you think about it, that's because you can't have a massless particle decay into 2 other massless particles, something probably many of you have seen. The only way you could do it, there's sort of vanishing phase space for it. The only way you can do it is for a particle of energy E to come along and split into 2 particles of energy exactly E over 2. Okay? So that's a one exact single point that allows that to happen. So that's why we normally don't talk about it. But while you can't have one particle goes to 2 particles with real momenta, you can have one particle goes to 2 particles if the momenta are complex. Okay, so let me just show you how that works. So let me just give you an example. Like, let's say this particle is 1, 1, 0, 0. Okay? Then I can have this split into 1, 1, 1, i. So -1, -1, -1, -i. And 0, 0, 1, i. So momentum is clearly conserved. And all the p squareds are 0. All the p squareds are 0 because of the I. Okay. Now, you might say, this isn't physical. You're not allowed to talk about complex momenta. There's no such thing as a complex momenta. One of the reasons I'm talking about this particular thing here is this is another element of research skills that you'll have to get used to. This is another element of not letting your preconceptions and prejudices block you from doing something which could be mathematically natural. Okay? You see, it turns out to be an incredibly good thing to study the amplitudes for complex momenta, even though they're only defined for real momenta. Okay? What happens more technically is when you compute the amplitudes in a certain approximation, when you compute them in this tree-level approximation particularly, then the statement I'm about to say is very simple, then you find that even though you compute the amplitudes for real momenta, that they extend to complex momenta as meromorphic functions. So functions that only have poles in the complex plane. Okay? but are otherwise away from poles holomorphic. There's no branch cuts. They just have poles in the complex plane. Well, it's always a good idea to if there's something physical and it has a natural extension, it's a good idea to see what it does away from the naively physical region. Okay? And this has been a good idea in physics over and over and over again. That you walk into some set of problems and ideas, but it's the physics itself is leading you by the nose to move away from the place that you came in from. You compute the amplitudes for real momenta, and then you see, oh, that's very interesting. They're actually nice and analytic for arbitrary complex momenta. Let's look at them there. I wonder, is there anything nice about it? And then something immediately nice happens, which is that you find that a process which, for real momenta, you can't quite talk about, you can beautifully talk about for complex momentum. See, this is really nice because every time we draw Feynman diagrams, you know, this kind of three-point interaction plays a very, very special role. And yet, there is never an amplitude associated with it. That's really funny. It's really funny that this basic three-pronged interaction occurs everywhere, and yet the first physical amplitudes that we talk about are 2-to-2 scattering. Okay? That's an artifact of working with real momenta. In complex momentum, there's also a 3-to-3 scattering, a three-point scattering that you can talk about. All right. Well, actually, let's think about this then a little more generally. So I just give you one example of a complex momentum. But I want you to see something truly extraordinary about this object. This amplitude for completely general helicities, H1, H2, and H3, turns out to be up to an overall constant, completely determined. Totally 100% determined. No freedom in it whatsoever. Well, let's get a little warmed up to the idea of why there's no freedom. Let's say it's just scalars for a second. Yes?
It's a constant function of p1, p2, p3.
No, it's a constant, period. It's not a function of anything.
I mean,
its form is 100% determined.
So, okay.
And that's for any kind of part?
It only depends on the helicities, h1, h2, and h3.
Ah.
Okay.
Oh.
And the reason is, if you follow what you were just asking, is where we're about to go. What could it be a function of? Let's say there are scalars. Okay. You think it could be, couldn't it be a function of things like S, T, and U? Things, functions of the momenta? Well, let's start building Lorentz invariants. What are the Lorentz invariants that I could have? Again, P1 squared, P2 squared, P3 squared vanish. What about P1 dot P2? What is P1 dot P2? P1 dot P2 is also zero. Right? Because P1 dot P2, P1 plus P2 squared is minus P3, is minus P3 squared is zero. So P1 dot P2 is zero. There's no Lorentz invariance at all. Okay? So for four particles, immediately, when we did the graviton, we could pull out all the stuff that had the helicity dependence in it. But everything else was just, there was this big function of S, T, and U. There's no analog of the functions of S, T, and U. So this is a really cool object. All it can depend on are spinner helicities. Okay? It can't depend on them in pairs like this that look like momenta. So in fact, let's look a little more carefully at what this could look like. So let me write the three momenta, and let me write the statement of momentum conservation. See, now I'm dealing with complex momenta, so I treat lambda tilde 1 and lambda 1 as distinct. They're now really totally independent objects. Lambda 1 and lambda tilde 1 are totally independent. All of them are totally independent. Now, from the fact that I know that all these inner products are zero, I know, for example, that 1, 2 times 1,2 is 0. 1,3 times 1,3 is 0. And 2,3 times 2,3 is 0. All of these inner products are 0, right? So let's say we take the top one. So either 1,2 is 0 or 1,2 is 0. Okay? It's a consequence of the top equation. But we'll now show something very nice, that let's say 1,2 is 0. Then momentum conservation is going to imply that, in fact, all of them are 0. And this will imply the other one. So let's see why that is. So let's say 1,2 is 0. Okay. Well, let me then if 1,2 is 0, then let me take this equation and let me dot the, so there's an alpha and an alpha dot index on all of these guys, right? Okay. If 1,2 is 0, let me take the alpha index here in this equation, and I'm going to dot it into lambda 2. Okay. If it's lambda 2, then because 1,2 is 0, that one vanishes. Lambda 2 dotted into itself vanishes. This dot product is with an antisymmetric. So this is the area between 1,2 is the area between 1 and 2. So dotted into itself, it vanishes. So that one vanishes. So then I get that 2,3 times lambda tilde 3 is equal to 0. Okay. So then 2,3 has to vanish. And and then once I know that 2,3 vanishes, I can go back to this whole thing and dot it into lambda 3. And then I find that 1,3 vanishes. So momentum conservation tells me that if one of these vanish, all of them vanish. If the other one vanish, all of them vanish. Okay? That tells you something about the configuration of the lambdas and the lambda tildes that are compatible with momentum conservation. 1,2, 1,3, and 2,3 vanishing tells you that the spinner helicities, lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda 3, all lie on the same line. Okay? So the configuration is that lambda 1, 2, and 3, whatever they are, lie on the same line. But the lambda tildes can be anything. Literally, these are two-dimensional complex vectors, right? Or the other way around. Or the other way around. Now that's extremely beautiful because it tells you that the amplitude can either depend on angle brackets or on square brackets because the other guys are 0. Okay? So let's say that we are now talking about a totally general amplitude with helicities H1, H2, and H3. Then in complete generality, all it can be is either 1,2 to some power A1, 2,3 to some power A2, 3,1 to some power A3, or 1,2 to some power, 2,3 to some power, 3,1 to some power. Okay? And in fact, you can see that the only powers it could be is the other way around, right? Minus A1, minus A2, minus A3. Okay? That's all it could be. And now we have to solve for these powers in order for this thing to have the correct weight. So for example, under rescaling 1, let's take the top one. Under rescaling 1, we find A1 plus A3 has to equal negative 2H1. And cyclically, okay? A2 plus A3, A3 plus A2 has to equal negative 2H. Oh, sorry, what am I doing? That's what I'm doing wrong. Let me label these more intelligently. I apologize. 1, 2 to the A3, 2, 3 to the A1, 3, 1 to the A2. Okay? How do you label them like that? Then for 1, I find A3 plus A2 has to equal negative 2H1, and cyclically. So let me write this as A2 plus A3 has to equal negative 2H1. A3 plus A1 has to equal negative 2H2. And A1 plus A2 has to equal negative 2H3. That's one solution, or the other way around, right? Or A2 plus A3 is equal to negative, positive. Anyway, so let's just do that kind of object first. Okay? So these are three equations and three unknowns that you can solve for H1, H2, and H3, for A1, A2, and A3. And so you can solve them. And you find that A1 is equal to, so for example, A3 is equal to minus 2H1 minus 2H2 plus 2H3. Yeah, that's right. Okay. And cyclically. Okay. Sorry?
Sorry, you're right.
This is right, yeah. The problem is I changed the convention from what I normally do for the definition of H. In this lecture, and that's why I keep getting confused. Yes, that's right.
Okay.
So let's just instantly do an example. What is the 3-point graviton amplitude? Okay. Well, if this is minus and minus and plus, how much are these? So it would be minus 2, minus 2, plus 2. That is a graviton. Then this is 1, 2 cubed . So you see this is right, okay? So the weight of 1 is 6 minus 2, which is 4. That's right. Weight of 2 is 4, and the weight of 3 is minus 4, which is what it should be, because it's a positive velocity. Now, actually, I could have also written down something else, okay? So this would be the amplitude in the case where it's the lambdas that are pointing in different directions and the lambda bars which lie in a straight line. I could have written the other way around as 1, 2 to the minus 6 over 1, 3 to the minus 2, 2, 3 to the minus 2. I could have written that as well. That has the correct That has the correct weights. However, in the limit where the momenta are real, you don't want the amplitude to blow up. Because we know, in fact, the amplitude should vanish in the limit where the momenta are real. Okay? And so in the limit where these products go to zero, we want this whole amplitude to vanish and not blow up. Here it blows up. Here it vanishes correctly. Okay? In other words, the limit where the momenta are real is where the lambda is equal to lambda tilde is lambda star. Right? So the limit where the momenta are real here is this degenerate situation where even though the lambda tildes could be in pointing in general directions, the lambdas are lying on a straight line, the real momenta is the case where the three lambda tildes are also lying on a straight line. That's the real momenta. In that situation, it had better be this amplitude vanishes and doesn't blow up. That's what tells you that you can't choose this case, because in this case, as you spend all these three vectors to be parallel, then all of these products are going to zero, but the whole thing would go to infinity. Okay? Whereas this case, the whole thing goes to zero in the analogous limit. So further demanding that the amplitude vanishes for real momenta nails its form completely. Okay. So we can now write down up to an overall constant, right? Up to an overall constant, we can write down this amplitude for any spin configurations. Okay? And we just wrote it down. So if we were to do it, let's say we have a single particle all of spin s. I mean, you can do this for anything, any spins, right? But let's say we specialize to a single particle of spin s, 1, 2, 3, then if it looks like plus, plus, if it looks like plus, minus, minus, plus, then it's what we just wrote down. It's 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the power of s. If it's the other way around, if it's plus, plus, minus, then it's 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the power of s. And I'll leave you to work out what it might be if it's all plus or all minus. Okay? But one thing you will find when you do it is that the units of whatever coupling occurs here, you see here they have the same units. You'll find that the units of the analogous coupling here are different. That makes it completely clear that these two kinds of interactions are coming from different things, different theories. And in fact, the usual GR is only giving you these guys and not these guys. Okay? These would correspond to higher order terms that you could add in the Einstein-Hilbert action. Terms that involve the Ricci tensor cubed, the Ricci scalar cubed, for example. Okay. But in any case, the things that you get straight from the Einstein-Hilbert action are just this. Similarly, for the interactions of spin 1 particles, what you get just from the Yang-Mills Lagrangian is just this. Now, again, I want you to see, yes?
Sorry, what's the s?
Oh, this is particles of spin s.
Okay.
So if they all have spin s, but and these are their helicities, minus s, and so that would be minus s plus s, vice versa. So, yeah, yes?
Convention, why not the denominator, why not 1, 3, to the power minus 1, 2, 3 to the power minus 1, the square bracket.
Where?
The last.
Here?
Yes.
Yep.
You have 3 to the power minus, 1, 2 to the power minus 3.
I have 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3. Yeah. All to the power of s. So again, this has all the correct scalars, right? This has 3s, minus s, 2s. So that's exactly correct. Yes?
A board back, erase it now, but you had the 1, 2s in the triangle brackets?
Yes.
The corresponding exponents for the square brackets were negative?
Yes.
So I think, on the right board there, shouldn't they be flipped? 1, 2 should be on the bottom? And
No, because I flipped what the helicities are here.
Oh, okay. I see.
So I could have written up here as well. I could have also written 1, 2 to the minus 3. Over 1, 3 to the minus 1, 2, 3 to the minus 1.
But that one blows up
But that one blows up in a moment of real momentum. So that's why I cross this one out. Okay. So in other words, the form of this three particle amplitude is fully fixed by Poincaré invariants. It's fully fixed by Lorentz invariants, translations that tells you momentum is conserved, Lorentz invariants, and the requirement that the amplitude is non-singular in the limit of real momentum. That entirely, completely fixes the form of the amplitude. Yes?
So is it possible to put two of these together to get a standard real momentum Feynman diagram?
That's the fascinating part. The answer turns out to be yes, although in a quite interesting way. The answer turns out to be yes, but not simply putting them together. But anyway, before talking about that, I want to tell you for the umpteenth time that this again shows the power of working very directly with physical observables. Okay? This three particle amplitude, even if you were to get it from, so Feynman diagrams give you things in terms of momenta and polarization vectors, you could compute that for fun for complex momenta, and you would get this answer. But those 80 terms in the Einstein-Hilbert action collapse into this answer. Okay. Furthermore, you see that there's like interesting and obvious relationships between some of these basic three-particle amplitudes. For example, the three-particle amplitude for gravity is the square of the three-particle amplitude for Yang-Mills theory. The spin 1 amplitude squared is the spin 2 amplitude. That's a kind of a cool relationship. Okay? In fact, analogs of that relationship persist to higher and higher orders. Now, if I handed you the Einstein-Hilbert action and I hand you the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, and I asked you, do you think there should be any relationships between the scattering amplitudes between these two theories? They couldn't look more different from each other. Okay? And yet, there are these deep similarities between them, completely obscured in the usual formalism, but which are actually there. Okay. But this really is a remarkable statement. It's not even a statement in perturbation theory. It's an exact statement, because it follows from absolutely nothing other than symmetry considerations. Okay? Symmetry considerations completely nail the form of this three-particle amplitude. By the way, they also nail it for a spin 17 particle, for anything. But I told you yesterday there's something wrong with the amplitudes of high spin particles. Okay? So there has to be some other physical requirement. It isn't merely enough to write down amplitudes, to write down functions that have the correct scalings. Okay? We have to demand other things in order for this to be consistent with a physical amplitude. And one of the physical things that we have to demand is the following. This is called factorization. And this is really putting in the physics of locality. See, what we're doing in attempting to just directly, I haven't been computing any Feynman diagrams for you, right? We're trying as much as possible to get the answers based on general principles without putting in diagrams. But diagrams were giving us something. They were telling us for sure that the interactions are happening locally in space, things propagate from here to there, and so on. Okay? So we need to figure out what is the imprint in the scattering amplitudes of that fact, that the interactions are actually taking place locally in space-time. Even though we're measuring them at infinity, what is the imprint of that fact, that they're actually taking place in space-time? At least when you draw Feynman diagrams that are just tree-like like this, they don't have any loops in them. We can take even without computing them, we learn one important thing from just staring at the structure of these pictures. Let me draw another one of these here. Okay, here's some complicated diagram. Okay. But let me, for example, look at whatever else is going on in this diagram. There is a propagator factor associated, let's say, with that line. Okay. Now, what is the momentum flowing through that line? The momentum flowing through that line is actually the sum of this momentum, that momentum, that momentum, and that momentum. Right? These are external momenta. So it's a sum of all of these external momenta. Okay? So whatever else is going on, there is a factor that looks like 1 over p1 plus p2 plus p3 plus p4 squared. There could be a hell of a lot of diagrams. In fact, let me draw a big blob. There could be a hell of a lot of diagrams that have 1, 2, and 3, and 4 on this side. They don't just have to look like this. But there's some subset which will have this particle here, and which will have everything else on the other side. But flowing through that line is p1 plus p2 plus p3 plus p4. Okay. And so there is this factor, 1 over p1 plus p2 plus p3 plus p4 squared. So therefore, there is some singularity that occurs in these Feynman diagrams. They blow up, they become large, when p1 plus p2 plus p3 plus p4 squared is equal to 0. Okay. Now, I told you yesterday that singularity, when you have this propagator factor, the singularity is p squared goes to 0, is simply interpreted as actually the emission of a real particle that moves in space. Okay. So that's actually what's happening. The reason why, I mean, if these momenta are generic positions, generic values, then p1 plus p2 plus p3 plus p4 squared is not equal to 0. And we would colloquially say this is a virtual particle. Okay? And we have to sum over all the Feynman diagrams with all these virtual particles going in every way. However, when p1 plus p2 plus p3 plus p4 squared is equal to 0, then the blow-up that's happening is because this particle is actually real. It's becoming a real on-shell particle. So that should tell you something physical. That should tell you that the coefficient of that thing that's blowing up, the residue, if you like, should be the product of two actual physical amplitudes. This should be the product of the amplitude with 1, 2, 3, 4, and that guy as a physical particle, times the amplitude of that guy and the rest of them as a physical amplitude. So in other words, when you take any subset of the external momenta, and when you add them up and their squares go to 0, the amplitude should factorize, should split into the product of two lower point amplitudes. So in other words, in general, in complete generality, if I have 1, 2, 3, 4, up to n, then if any subset of the momenta, if the sum of some I in some subset of the momenta, let's call it I, of pi squared goes to 0, then this big amplitude, m, should go into m of the particles in the set I plus one more, Well, let me draw it pictorially. Okay. Then M should factorize into this amplitude times this amplitude, times this factor, 1 over the sum of pi squared. Now, of course, in general, there's many, if we have particles with spin, there are many helicities. Okay, so I have to sum over all the helicities of this state as well. So if the helicity here is h, then again, since I'm thinking of everything as incoming in all these pictures, then here I would call have to call the helicity minus h, and I have to sum over h as well. So, but these are my external particles. This would be the set which is an I. This would be the set which is not an I. Okay, and this is one extra intermediate guy. Okay. And I sum over the helicities of this intermediate state. So this is not true at any old p's, right? After all, at any old p's, remember, these amplitudes, Feynman diagrams are, a Feynman diagram would be identical. This Feynman diagram makes sense even if this particle is off-shell. In fact, this is the whole point of Feynman diagrams. It makes it very easy to sum up all these off-shell things. Amplitudes are only defined when all the particles are on-shell. Okay? So this is not true for totally generic momenta. But it's telling you that in order for the amplitudes to reflect the physics, that things are taking place and then propagating and then happening somewhere else, that that the poles of the amplitude have to reflect that local physics. And this is how they do it. The poles reflect it such that if you take any subset of the external momenta and their sum squares to zero, then that should correspond to the emission out of this initial state of some physical on-shell particle that travels a long distance and then interacts on the other side. The divergence is just precisely that long distance that is propagating. Okay. So this is an incredibly powerful constraint. If someone hands you now a bunch of amplitudes, and you look at them all, a bunch of objects, and they all have a nice weight under the Lorentz group and everything looks great, but you want to ask yourself, could this possibly come from a local theory? Then this is the check that you would do. You would now look at you would see if this object has poles, and you look at the residues on the poles. And the residues on the poles have to factorize in this way. Okay? Now I'll give you an exercise. Because we just defined the three-particle amplitude for any old theory. Okay? So let's say we define it for any old theory. Let me just restrict myself to theories of particles where all of a single particle of spin s. Single particle spin s, and I'll write it down again. So and let's say I'm just looking at these amplitudes. So again, this one was 1, 2 up to some constant. It was 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the s. And or if it was the other way around, minus s plus s, it was a constant times 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the s. Okay? So I could do this for any old amplitude. By the way, I maybe should have said something quickly. The reason I'm saying those constants are the same is that, and this is something that you should think about and quickly verify, is the action of parity is to exchange lambda and lambda tilde. Exchange angle and square brackets. So if you want your theory to have parity, then it should be the same under exchanging angle and square brackets. And that's why I'm saying that these constants are actually the same. If the constants were different, then whatever I'm writing down wouldn't be a parity invariant theory, which could be fine, but I'm just restricting myself to talking about the parity invariant ones. Okay. So if you like, this three-particle amplitude is the basic object that defines the theory. It's the most primitive thing that there can possibly be. And this primitive thing can make sense even for spin 17 particles. However, what happens is the following. Let's say you now try to define a four-particle amplitude. Okay. By the same, and let's say I try to do the one that we talked about before. 1 plus, 2 plus, 3 minus, 4 minus, let's say. Okay. Then I can write this again as 1, 2, 3, 4 to the power of 2s times some function of s, T and U. Okay. However, factorization is an incredibly strong constraint, on what this function S, T and U can be. Okay. So in this simple case, it had better be that if, let's say, if one and two are going on shell, then this thing had better factorize, right? So these are called the different factorization channels. So if p1 plus p2 squared goes to 0, by which I mean if 1,2 times 1,2 is set to 0, then it had better be that whatever this is factorizes into something that looks like that times that. Right? So this would be 1 plus 2 plus. This would be 3 minus 4 minus. Okay? There would have to be a factor of 1 over 1, 2, 1, 2, which is blowing up. So this is heading to 0. But if you strip off that factor, you should find that what's left is the product of this three-particle amplitude times that three-particle amplitude. And remember, I told you we have to sum over the internal helicities here. Well, what could the helicity be? Because the only three-particle amplitudes I have are plus, plus, minus, that would have to be minus, that would have to be plus, so that's happy. Okay. So the amplitude has to factorize like that. If p2 plus p3 squared goes to 0, then the amplitude has to factorize the other way, right? It has to factorize into something that looks like this. 2 plus 3 plus something here, something, minus 4 minus 1 plus. And then this helicity would have to be, well, it could be plus or minus, right? So it could be plus here and minus there, or it could be minus and plus. You'd have to sum over two possibilities there, okay? But it would have to factorize into this multiplied by 1 over 2, 3, 2, 3, which is heading to 0. So again, the residue, as it's heading to 0, the coefficient of the piece that's getting divergent has to be the product of two three-particle amplitudes. Well, we know what these are, right? We just wrote down their totally general form. So we know what these are. So all you have to do is look at this, write this general expression, and just demand these conditions. Okay? If you demand those conditions and the Bose symmetry of everything, of course, because we have a single particle of spin S. Let's say the spin is even, just so we don't have to worry about. Then you will find, so that's the exercise. This is not a trivial exercise, okay? But it's not a very hard exercise either. Then you'll find that there's only two possibilities for the function of S, T, and U. And that only occurs for two different values of the spin S. Oh, I'm sorry, there's an S and an S there, but anyway, let's call this a script S. Okay? You'll find there's only two solutions consistent with factorization. One is when S is equal to 0, and the function of S, T, and U is 1 over S, plus 1 over t plus 1 over u. And the second one is when s equals 2 and the function of s, t, and u is 1 over s, t, u. And that's it. This case corresponds to a phi-cubed scalar field theory. If you have a phi-cube scalar field theory, then in this case, the Feynman diagrams are pretty easy. Even without knowing very much, you would see that they look like this and like that, sum of three terms. And the vertices of these diagrams are just constants. There's a 1 over s, a 1 over t, and a 1 over u. And a sum of three terms, and that's what you get. In the gravity case, if you did it with Feynman diagrams, you would take hundreds of pages. The answer is not 1 over s plus 1 over t plus 1 over u. It's 1 over s to u. But we got it here just from, oh, by the way, and then you'd also get the coefficient, right? So I put in the coefficient c. So this would be c squared, and that would be c squared with some numbers that you can get exactly. Okay. But this shows that C defines the theory. The magnitude up to C, the form was completely fixed, right? Up to C, the form of the three-particle amplitude was totally fixed. So the value of C defines the theory. And then putting that in, there's a unique four-particle amplitude that's compatible with the three-particle amplitude and factorization. Okay? So there's absolutely no choice to what the four-particle amplitude is. And there's actually a pretty easy, there's a fairly easy mathematical requirement on F that's imposed by factorization. Let me just tell you what it is. Just if you're trying to do this exercise, what you should be gunning for is to see that the limit as S goes to 0, let's say, of F of S, T, and U times S has to be 1 over s to the spin little s, okay? Oh, sorry, 1 over it's got to be 1 over t, for example, to the power of the spin. And similarly for the other two guys. So this is the mathematical requirement, which ends up having two solutions, only two solutions. Okay, one of them is with capital S equal with little s, the spin s equals 0, and you see this is 1 over s plus 1 over t plus 1 over u, and the other one with s equals 2. With s equals 2, what happens is that as s times, if I look at s times this guy, you see it turns into 1 over t u, but u is equal to negative t. As s goes to 0, so this whole thing goes like t squared, which is spin equals 2. But when you do it for a general spin, you find that it's impossible to find a symmetric function of s, t, and u that satisfies this condition. And this condition ends up being what is demanded by factorization here. Okay, so that's the exercise that you'd have to do to see that that works out precisely. But that's what the requirement is. So we see now from a second point of view why the only consistent interacting theories of massless spin of massless particles is, in this case, just phi cube theory and GR. You can say, what happened to Yang-Mills theory? I said a single spin 1 particle, a single spin s particle. Right? This was just for a single spin s particle. There is no, the interaction between multiple spin 1 particles in the Yang-Mills theory is antisymmetric in the indices. So it vanishes for a single particle. If you repeat this exercise, then for Yang-Mills theory, you would put in A, B, C for particles 1, 2, 3. Okay? And I would say that this 3-particle amplitude is FABC times 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3. Let's say this was minus, minus, plus. Okay? Then when you repeat this factorization exercise, you find that everything can work, but with a proviso. Okay? You see, the factorization is now telling you something about something with an A, B, C, and a D, and it's telling you that it has to turn into something that has the product of two Fs. Right? This has an F in it, that has an F in it. Okay? So this factorization can work, but only if the FABCs satisfy a quadratic constraint, FF plus FF plus FF equals 0, which is known as the Jacobi identity. That's the identity that tells you that these FABCs can be the structure constants of a Lie group. So once again, this is how you discover that the only way of consistently talking about massless spin 1 particles is to associate their interaction strength with the structure constants of a Lie group. But anyway, it's already an exciting exercise to go through this argument and understand why the only consistent theories of a spin massless, a single massless particle of spin s, there's only two theories, phi cube theory, and there are only two theories that have a cubic vertex, okay? Phi cube theory and GR, and you can not only show that it's true, but also compute directly what the scattering amplitude is as well. Now, one of the important developments of the last number of years has been to actually answer the question someone asked, which is somehow can you, in some sense, like Feynman diagrams, but not Feynman diagrams, put these, you know, here I laboriously did a check. I wrote down the most general form of the 4-particle amplitude, and I demanded that it has the correct factorization property. And then I nailed its form completely. Okay? But now, clearly, that's going to get more and more complicated if you want to find 5-point, 6-point, 7-point. Is there some systematic way of kind of gluing these pictures together in the way that you think you might? Okay? You might say, isn't this just like Feynman diagrams? And the answer is no, these are not Feynman diagrams, because every single thing here involves all the particles being on shell somehow. Okay? So the things that you're gluing together are full and complete amplitudes. There's nothing off shell. The word off shell means that you're talking about the inside of space-time. Something off shell is going from here to there, right? It's being emitted and absorbed. It isn't going from minus infinity to infinity. So if the entire philosophy is to work with things that are defined from minus infinity to infinity, you should not see anything off shell ever, if that's what you're trying to do. As it turns out, that there are ways of putting together the 3-particle amplitude in a systematic way to build up any amplitude. And that's one of the hints, at least for tree-level processes. That is one of the hints that there really is a second formulation that directly gives you that way of computing them. They're shockingly more effective than Feynman diagrams, truly shockingly more effective than Feynman diagrams. and are actually where many of the ideas were inspired by some very old ideas of Roger Penrose to think about space-time physics in terms of light rays that go out to infinity and a mathematical structure known as twister space. So thinking about physics in twister space has greatly inspired these much, much better ways of doing computations in quantum field theory. So this is the part which is still greatly in development. But I wanted you to see, so that's all I'm going to say about this subject. The exercise that I encourage you to do is first really go through the, really try to understand this three-particle amplitude properly. Try to understand the geometry that we just talked about properly, the lambda and lambda tilde geometry properly. Okay, and second, try to go through this argument. This is not something you do in half an hour. Once you get your feet wet, it is something you do in half an hour. But it's not totally trivial, and it's a nice meaty problem that you can think about. But if you succeed, you will have completely proven from totally general principles that you can't have a spin 3 particle, single massless spin 3 particle. The only possible massless spin 2 particle is a graviton, and you would have computed the 2-to-2 graviton scattering amplitude ab initio, okay, completely fixed by Poincaré invariance. This is quite a feat, given that it took Bryce DeWitt 100 pages to do it in 1969, the same calculation. But it really shows you the power of thinking very invariantly about what the actual physical quantities are. The actual scattering amplitudes in four dimensions are these objects, as I hope you see, there's lots of very beautiful mathematical structure associated with them, and I think very, very strongly think actually a dual formulation of standard physics in other variables that makes a lot of these properties much, much more manifest. All right, that's it. So I think tomorrow what I will do is, I haven't decided. I might either go a little further with this, or I might switch completely and talk about horizons, which is the kind of last one of the topics that I mentioned on the first day that I haven't discussed at all. Awaken you a little bit to why the physics of horizons is so interesting. So maybe we'll do horizons tomorrow. We'll do horizons. Yes.
The specific
exercise is to complete the steps that I just did. It's to take this. As I say, it's not a half-hour exercise. Well, one thing that you could do, a simpler exercise would be to actually. Let's say here's something. Go through what I said already, but write down what the three particle amplitude is in QED. Okay. Massless QED. Imagine that the electron was massless. What is the three particle amplitude of one photon, an electron, and two electrons and a photon. Okay, so you'd have to go through the entire argument. We gave the totally general answer, but I want you to see it. Just write it down. But go through the argument of momentum conservation in terms of these spinners written in that way. Go through the argument that you have these two degenerate solutions, one where the lambdas are parallel and the lambda tildes are not, and the other way around, and then see if you can understand why it has precisely the structure it has. And that gives you the three particle amplitude. That's something, again, in the standard field theory textbooks is written down as the Feynman vertex with the gamma mu or something like that in it. And then you have to dot it into polarization vectors. And once again, you never see what it actually looks like. Okay? So just work out what the vertex is for QED. That's one nice exercise. Another exercise, but the really meaty exercise is to try to take this for the single particle spin s, try to take this general form of the four-product amplitude and see the restrictions on capital F that are imposed by requiring that it factorize this product. And I've told you ahead of time what it turns out to be. It turns out to be this. Okay, so try to verify that it turns out to be this. Once it is this, you can show that there's only two possible solutions. One that corresponds to particle with spin 0, and the other one that corresponds to particle with spin 2. So I think that's plenty for a couple of hours. Yes?
Oh, sorry, I can just ask one. I was lost way back in the beginning where, so we have M labeled by the HX?
Yes.
And